Lyle, come on and Lyle, we read since we're in Revelation, in the course of looking at an ultimate one world system, we read, I think, last Sunday your postcard about how backing off on the thorns, you call them, such as infallibility of the Pope and Mary and so forth, in the interest of ecumenical movement. And if you have a little more to say about that, you might do so.
Thank you for praying for me. I appreciate it. And I felt the force of your prayer very, very much. It was a great experience. I went. I was at the University of Notre Dame, South Bend, Indiana, in the Graduate School of Theology, in a course called Sacramental Theology. If you know anything about Catholicism, you know that for about 13, 14 centuries, the means of salvation described by the Catholic Church was by entering the Catholic Church through the rite of baptism, submitting to the sacraments, which are a cradle-to-grave system to impart grace to the faithful, and through that means you were offered some very, very slim hope of glory, usually through purgatory, a place they invented for handling unconfessed sin in this life, or for working off penances that weren't complete. At any rate, the sacramental theology class was, as I suspected, a bombshell, literally. The Catholic theologian we had was a lady, a dear lady from Georgetown University, and she described herself as a liberation theologian, that is, one who embraces Catholic teaching with Marxist practice. But she was not a revolutionary. She didn't want to give out the rifles in order to bring about a one-world government, one-world economic order, by way of a one-world religion. But that was her goal, and the goal of others like her is to do away with the sacramental system as such and simply make it a system wherein everyone works for self uplifting, and by that means social progress and movement to peace, equal distribution of wealth, the end of the armaments race, the end of patriotism and nationalism and imperialism, and ultimately utopia or a millennial reign established by men. Now, the first 3 days I was there, I didn't know what was going on. Catholic theologians work from a philosophic base. She and others like her are existentialists. That is, people who, broadly speaking, have given up on the world as it is and yet have determined that their responsibility is to struggle to make it a better world. But from that philosophic base, frankly, I was lost. We're biblically based. She described the Bible as a book of fairy tales, and you can imagine then what ensued. Well, it was worthwhile, because if this attitude should prevail, in the short run, I think it could lead to a total break with Rome. There could be an American Catholic Church. It would mean the ordination of women. It would mean married priests. It would mean an open stance on abortion. And it would be one big happy family. We had a number of nuns in the class that had just come back from Central America, very warm toward the Nicaraguan Sandinista government. I thought they were guys till I got close to them. They didn't look like nuns. Blue jeans, T-shirts, zipper jackets, Nikes. different people. But when they called one another Sister Anne and Sister Mary, I knew where I was. But it was great. It really was. From the point of view of the material it came across, that was great. I think in the short run, we could see an American Catholic Church. In the long run, if their view should prevail worldwide, and they're certainly working hard toward that end, it would remove all the obstacles to a union of Protestant groups, Anglicans, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Presbyterians, others in the National World Council of Churches. There's nothing left to hold them out if these people prevail. They're opposed to the infallibility of the Pope, worship of Mary, apostolic succession, all the things that have been troublesome. They don't believe in either. So they've taken a long step toward ecumenical union. My other goal, of course, was to go and witness to nuns and priests. I didn't have a lot of such experiences, but I had excellent in-depth conversations. The class was 2 hours each day, didn't start till 3:45 in the afternoon. I got there early in the morning, and anywhere people congregated, I was there trying to get a word in edgewise. Notre Dame's a hard school to stay alive in academically. They only take the upper 10% in undergraduate school and less than that in graduate school. So anytime someone sat down, it was not to just drink a can of pop and talk about the weather or baseball. They've either got a book to read, a paper to write, or both. But we got in some good conversations. And the change in Romanism is almost, it's almost at flank speed. And where it will end, hard to say. But it's certainly interesting, and it's certainly a thing to watch. But there's a substantial growing movement to take care of all those problems that have, up to this hour, stood in the way of a one-world government coming into being. They've got it in mind and heart, and the intelligentsia is certainly moving that way. Thank you again for your prayer. I felt the force of it, as I said, and we appreciated it so very much. Thank you, Pastor.
While he's still up here, do you want to ask him anything?
I passed.
Bruce, did you have something?
I was just going to ask about the force of communism connected with Catholicism. How is that interrelated?
Fine. All of the bishops in Brazil, for example, are liberation theologians. That is, they've imbibed the teaching of a Peruvian priest named Gustavo Gutierrez and a Franciscan priest named Boff. These two fellas have taken papal encyclicals written over the last century. Anything that suggested the church stood for social progress, for the rights of the poor, and they've taken that and a Marxist dialectic. The synthesis that capitalism can't succeed, should fall of its own weight, and that there should be distribution, redistribution of the wealth to each according to his need. And what they're simply saying is the Marxists, though atheists, are doing what our church has always stood for. And we believe that it's Christian then to carry out this sort of a program. It sounds inconsistent, doesn't it? But it makes a whole lot of sense to them. Father Boff, for 18 months, was forbidden to preach, teach, or offer the sacraments. The Pope lifted that ban from him, and right now liberation theologians are in a state of grace with Rome. Just don't get too wild and don't be too revolutionary, but you're free to hold to that theory. Now, the American theologians, this avant-garde group, they embrace the goals of Marxist Catholic doctrine, this liberation theology, without the radical chic and without the revolutionary urge. But they don't see anything inconsistent about it at all. Yes, ma'am. Great. There's a young lady that sat behind me in class, Margaret Ibe from Rapid City, Michigan. She said, "Boy, if I went back to my parish and taught this, I'd be out of a job." And she said, "What? I don't know what we're going to do." Well, I said, I've been wondering about that myself. While I was at Notre Dame, we were blitzing the town of Germantown, Illinois, traditional Catholics, through the mailbox. I'm sure those 300 homes there know nothing about what was taught at Notre Dame and would be horrified to hear about it. So there'll always be these kinds of people. This is troublesome to this movement, this new movement. What do we do with traditional Catholics? The last day of class, another young lady, a Catholic school teacher from Cleveland, asked the professor, "What are we going to do about Catholics who still embrace traditional Catholic values?" And the professor said, "Well, we can't knock the rosary out of their hand, can we?" He said, "We'll just have to work with them and show them that these are the lingering attachments of a bygone day. We'll have to bring them up into the 20th century." It was the most shattering thing I heard the entire time I was there, and I heard a lot of shattering things. But it is a problem in their courses, you're suggesting. There are millions of Catholics who know no other kind of Catholicism. They've got a big job ahead. Yes, sir.
Does Notre Dame support this class? Does it even know what's going
on? Oh, yeah, yeah. They hand-picked their faculty, and they knew who they were getting. We had an interlude with a Jesuit priest, Father Yarnold, who had just come from England, where he'd worked on the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, a group designed to work out the problems in union. And he was more revolutionary than anybody else I'd heard. Yes, these people were picked by design. I didn't talk to anyone on the Notre Dame theology faculty, but I have to believe that this is where their sentiment lies as well.
Do their churches on campus or around the campus, do they have the traditional Catholic service, or are they?
Yes, their Sacred Heart Church right on the grounds, Holy Cross Fathers officiate there. And you can have about any kind of Catholicism you want. They're getting like Baptists. Looks like I've exhausted Grace. Thank you, sir. Yes, the pastor asked about the charismatic Catholic renewal. A lot of them in my in that class I was in. We're about 60 in that class. Nuns, few priests, a good many Catholic school teachers, high school teachers of religion, and a number of them were charismatics. I was interested, first of all, with them in discovering whether or not they were genuinely born again. And I kept asking, well, my theory or my thesis all week was to ask the question, Acts 16:30, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" I never got the right answer. Most of the time, I never got any answer at all. And I asked that of the charismatics, and none of them knew what it meant to be born again. None of them knew what it really meant to be saved. Now, they all had an experience. They knew about speaking in tongues, and one of them told me she specialized in healing. I sat real close to her because I had an upset stomach, but it did nothing for me. But they look upon themselves in two ways. They look upon themselves as a persecuted minority within the Catholic Church. They're tolerated, they tell me. If they're allowed to have a meeting in the church, it's down by the boiler room. If they're allowed a time for their service, it's 5:30 p.m. on Thursday night when nobody can make it. And so they're a persecuted minority. They also believe that they're a prophetic minority. That is, that they've done a lot for the church and that they're going to liven up the place. And that if it gets anywhere spiritually, it will be they who do it. But as I said, I never found any who really could tell me succinctly how to be saved. So, you know, I think they just traded on an experience there. And time will tell about that. I think the church wisely has tolerated them because they're only about one heartbeat away from being evangelicals and fundamentalists, and the church realizes that, and if they get to be, if they give them a lot of trouble, I think they'd put them out. Yes, sir. I hope he thinks that the charismatics are unifying. Is that part of the implication of your question? Your comment. I don't see that they are. I didn't find any integral unity within them except that, oh, you had an experience? I had an experience. Boy, if you had only experienced the experience that I've experienced, what an experience. And that's about all I could find in the way of common ground there. But I'm sure Mr. Roberts Robertson, is that it? He's really, I'm sure he's counting on that if he's serious about his drive for the presidency. That's so? Well, you're dear and gracious people, and I appreciate you very, very much. Thank you.
Well, as we've said, we want to keep away and study the prophecy since we're in Revelation. Keep away from what we've called the this is that type of thing. But at the same time, I think it's extremely important when we know that what these folks are aiming for will happen. It's part of biblical prophecy, the one world type of thing. And so we know it will happen. To the extent that this identifies with that, leads up to it, is a trend toward it, of course that we do not know. And yet we ought to try to keep up with these things, see what's going on, because there certainly is a setting whereby people are willing to give up traditional beliefs in the interest of world unity, world community. And so appreciate that. It's very interesting. All right, let's go to Revelation chapter 5. And I believe by the time we finish tonight, we should be ready to begin with Revelation 6 that introduces us to the great or to the tribulation period of history. Chapters 4 and 5, as we have indicated, is introduction to it, setting for it, because we're taken to heaven. And the two things that are focused on is chapter 4, the throne in heaven. And then in chapter 5, we focus on the book in heaven. We looked at its appearance in verse 1. I saw in or on the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And that, of course, would be God the Father. And so the book is located on the hand of God the Father, written inside and on the back, and we notice that that was extremely unusual. The papyrus on which they wrote, made up of the verso and the recto side, was only written on the front, And very often, if they wanted more copy room, rather than turn it over, they would erase and write over the top of, and had the type of manuscript we call a palimpsest. But here you've got a very unusual thing, because the scroll, book as our translation gives it, scroll, was written inside and on the back. And I take the reason for that is to show that this is a full account that is going to come out. We're going to see a full account of things that are going to occur before the Lord's return. Then we looked at its divisions, sevenfold divisions of the book. Then in verses 2 through 5, we had the challenge. The challenge is presented in verse 2. I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the book and break its seals?" And then we have the response to that by failure, verse 4, 3 and 4, and by success in verse 5 and 6. First of all, the failure in verse 3. No one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the book or look into it. And this, of course, is looking at everyone without a view to Christ. And so the point is, the book is going to involve God holding forth his hand. Taking the book will imply that you can do what the right hand of God can do. And the essence of the book is going to be to right wrong and to bring in righteousness. Who can do it? And the answer to that is no one in heaven and earth can do it. And you have a very vivid description in verse 4 of what is the future like without Christ. What is history like without Christ as far as eschatology and prophecy is concerned? And in verse 4 you have it, I began to weep greatly because no one was found worthy to open the book or look into it. There is nothing ahead for this world except tears, great tears, until Jesus Christ returns and steps into the scene. And that is where we stopped then last time. And we are ready now to pick up with the victory, the appearance of the book, the challenge of the book, and now the victory. And that is stated for us in 5, 6, and 7. And we start with the person involved in verse 6. Now, the interesting thing is in linking verse 5 and 6 together. And the thing we want to note, and we'll say it first, then read it, and then say it again. And the point is this. Christ is called a lion. And John looks, and he sees a lamb. Notice the way that reads. Verse 5. One of the elders said to me, "Stop weeping. Behold," or look, "the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals. And I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb." So notice one of the elders says, "Look, a lion." He looks and he sees a lamb. Now, when you look at the lion-lamb referring to the same person, the first thing that appears is how opposite could you be? Because in fact, you look like you've got contradiction. How could he be a lion and a lamb at the same time? Simply because when you look at the lion, you've got majestic rule, kingship. When you look at the lamb, you've got submissive suffering. How do these two descriptions put together? Well, let's look at it this way. First of all, when you see Christ viewed as a lamb, the emphasis is on suffering in order to save. When you look at him as the lion, the emphasis is on reigning. And we would easily interpret that it was at the first advent that he did the suffering, and it is at the second advent that he will do the reigning. So the two terms nicely fit together, the career of Christ from the standpoint of the first and second advent. Suffering as a lamb, reigning as a lion. But there's another link, I think, between these two. And that is simply this, that the suffering was the condition and the reigning is the result. The concept that the cross must precede the crown permeates Scripture and is very, very much there, not only in terms of Christ, but in terms of our own glorification. The suffering has to precede the glorying. So you really have two aspects of the career of Christ. and you have the first condition, the Lamb that qualifies him through suffering. That also introduces a theme of the New Testament, and stop and think just how much this is a theme of the New Testament. Victory through sacrifice. And that is very much a theme of the New Testament. We have victory through the sacrifice of Christ. We have suffering in the Christian life that precedes glory. And that is very much a theme then of the New Testament. The book of Revelation has a unique way of reminding and tying together the Lamb and the Lion. And the interesting way that it does it is this. In the book of Revelation, Christ is called the Lion once. This is the only place it occurs in chapter 5 and in verse 5. He is called the Lamb better than 24 times in Revelation. Now why? What does this in effect do? Basically, as we see the person of Christ acting in judgment, judging and ruling, we're also reminded by the fact that he is called the Lamb that ties these two together. And I take it the reason that the Lion that is introduced from here on out is going to be called the Lamb is in order to identify the King and the Judge with the cross. So there's a link between his reigning and his judging in the book of Revelation, tying us right back to this is the Lamb of the cross. So the Judge of Revelation is also the Lamb of the cross, and we're reminded by that when we see judging activities, and he's called a Lamb. We call reigning activities, and he's called a Lamb. And therefore, while the early part of the New Testament associates the Lamb with suffering, Revelation associates the Lamb with judging and reigning, so that it is the same Lamb of the first that comes a second time, and Revelation nicely ties them together in that way. Now, notice the person is described from three standpoints, or three aspects of Christ is described here. Number one, he's described in terms of readiness. And that is seen two ways. First of all, it's seen in his posture. Verse 6. And I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb, notice, not slain, a lamb standing. There's a subtle implication right here. Doesn't the fact that it is a lamb standing point to the fact that the sacrificial work is past? His sacrificial work is past. Why? Because the lamb is no longer slain. The lamb is standing. What, by the way, does that imply? If he has been slain and he's standing, how could you have a standing slain lamb? A standing dead lamb. What is implied here? Notice the resurrection is implied. It's not taught, but it's implied because the lamb is not slain. The lamb is on its feet. And the lamb, of course, is Christ. The lamb points to the sacrificial work. That's all finished. That's done. That's past. Resurrection is implied. Another thing is implied by this is if you look at the posture of sitting, for example, in Hebrews 1, verse 3, it says when he had made a purification for sins, he sat down. And so the emphasis on sitting is on complete work. Completed work. Standing, on the other hand, indicates activity, and therefore the emphasis would be not on completed work, but on anticipated work. He's about to do something again. Notice also his location. Where is the Lamb standing? Well, we can see that from context, reading verse 6, and I saw between the throne, or literally, if you go to your margin, in the middle of the throne, with the four living creatures and the elders, a lamb standing. Where is the lamb? The lamb that was slain is in front of the throne. And what is that going to say about the work of the lion? The fact that he is located by the throne shows that the lamb is... Whose throne, by the way? Throne of God the Father. Shows he is accepted. Shows that he is approved. We have a doctrinal word for that. The fact that the work of Christ was adequate and sufficient, and it is approved and accepted by God the Father, is the doctrine of what? God the Father is satisfied, the doctrine of propitiation. So you've got that implied also at this point, that the cross work of the Son is acceptable to God the Father. He's been propitiated, and the Son stands at that location, ready now for new action. Emphasis on his readiness. All right? Second, notice there's an emphasis on his completeness. He's ready to act. And now an emphasis on completeness. And that is underscored two ways. Number one, he emphasizes the completeness of his sacrifice. Reading verse 6. I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb standing, slain. No, as if slain. So he is there as slain. And the word as is used because he is not slain now, he's alive now. So it's as slain because he is now living. He is not the slain lamb. He's the lamb who is as if slain. One of the interesting things about the book of Revelation is it's the only place where the death of Christ is viewed as a slaughter or where it is viewed as being slain. Nowhere else in the New Testament do you have this, this idea. And I take it the reason for that, the idea of being slain would point to the manner of death, the way he was slaughtered or the way he was slain. And I take it the reason he uses that is simply this. The marks of death remain. Marks of death remain. And we must remember that the remarks of Christ being slain remains. Look at John 20, verse 27. John 20, 27. And this, of course, is post-resurrection. Verse 26, after 8 days, again, his disciples were inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach here your finger and see my hands, and reach here your hand and put it into my side." So notice, with the resurrection of Christ, the marks of death still remain, and I take it in Revelation, when he points to the fact that this is the Lamb as if slain, the emphasis is the marks still remain and they are still there. The word slain, by the way, is, can you think through your Greek tenses? You're looking at the cross work, the sacrifice, as over with, what tense would you put it in? Perfect. And it is. Having been slain in time past with abiding results. All right, the completeness of his sacrifice. Second, the completeness of his power. Going back to Revelation 5, 6. Now, let's stop just a moment to do something or correct something that we may be trying to do. And when you try to do it, you get a monstrosity. Notice in verse 6, you have a slain lamb that has seven horns and seven eyes. Now, what is everybody probably doing? You're probably doing what you shouldn't do. You're trying to visualize, right? And when you visualize, what do you get? You get a monstrosity. I mean, here's this lamb that has been slain, and it's obvious it's been slain, and it's got these random... where'd you put your horns? In a row? One in the middle and three on the sides? Is that was your picture of it? What about the seven eyes? Were they in a row, or did you line them up, or did you put them all in the front, or around in a circle, or what? And when you begin to think of it, you begin to see, well, that's a monstrosity. It's a ridiculous type thing. And when a thing appears in our minds to be ridiculous, what does that do to the truth that we're trying to get a hold of? It makes it a smiling kind of thing. And we had that in Revelation. And therefore, very, very important to remember is this, and we'll simply put it under the idea of power, which has to do with the horns, is this. The throne room is not a graphic description of heaven. It is not graphic, but symbolic. It is not graphic, it is symbolic. In other words, we should not attempt to visualize a seven-horned, seven-eyed, slain lamb. If we do this throughout Revelation, we will see nothing but the grotesque. The point is, they didn't care about the visualization. They just wanted one being, and if it had to have seven horns to get across the idea of power, stick seven horns on it. If it needed seven eyes to indicate intelligence, give it seven eyes. The message is the point, not the graphics of it. If you are acquainted with, and I went to the library to look at some of them to see, the attempts by numerous middle-age artists to picture these things in Revelation, and there are several that have tried to picture the lamb here. One of them has the lamb in front of, with the background, is a French castle. And here is this lamb, and it has white wool, and in the white wool it has a slash wound and blood there. It has random horns. And its eyes, I believe, were all lined up, circling the head. And this was some of the middle age art. And of course, it was nothing more when you looked at it than a monstrosity. But this was a mistake made in the Middle Ages by artists when they tried to pick up on this, failing to recognize that this is not graphic. We're not supposed to see a picture. We're supposed to get the symbol that is involved in it. Now, what is involved? Notice coming down to verse 6. This person, which is Christ, has seven horns. John is not trying to draw a picture. He's trying to convey a message. Horns in the Bible inevitably are aggressive power. Aggressive strength. And just so we'll have some passage to associate with that, let's look at 2, Deuteronomy 33, verse 17, and Zechariah 1, 18 and 19. All we want to do is get the feel for the fact that in biblical imagery, horns represent aggressive power. Deuteronomy 33, verse 17. These are simply sample passages, and I think you'll pick it up right away. Verse 17 says, "As the firstborn of his ox, majesty is his, and his horns are the horns of a wild ox. With them he shall push the people." Notice the idea of aggressive power. "All at once to the ends of the earth." Then even more telling is Zechariah, next to the last book of the Old Testament, Zechariah 1. Zechariah 1. And this brings it right down to political powers and kingdoms. Chapter 1, verse 18. He says, "Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there were four horns. So I said to the angel who was speaking with me, 'What are these?'" Now, obviously, we didn't expect the answer, "Well, they're four horns."
He recognized they were four horns. The what is these is what do they mean? So he's identified them as horns already. He says, what are these or what do these mean? And he answered me, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. So the horns would be a reference to the Babylonians, the Assyrians, those that had attacked Israel. And you have the same thing down in verse 21, which says, what are these coming to? And he said, these are the horns that have scattered Judah, so that no man lifts up his head, but these craftsmen have come to terrify them, to throw down the horns of the nations who have lifted up their horns against the land of Judah in order to scatter. Aggressive power, and this consistently follows throughout the rest of the Old Testament. So that the Lord then, and we should add to that, there are seven, inevitably pointing to a completeness. So the emphasis then is a completed sacrifice, and now he is one who possesses a total power. From that, then, we move to an emphasis on his intelligence. Emphasis on his intelligence. Completeness, now his intelligence. And that is pointed out in verse 6 with the seven eyes. That would lead us back to Isaiah 11. We've been there before. Isaiah 11, 1 through 3. These are the seven spirits of God sent on all the earth. The idea of intelligence is involved. Therefore, the message, to summarize it up, is this. Jesus Christ, in this passage, is the only person to lay the basis for dealing with sin. And that is expressed in the fact that he was slain. That's the basis. He is the only one who has the power for dealing with sin. And that's expressed in the seven horns. He is the only one who has the intelligence and the wisdom for dealing with sins. And that is expressed in the seven eyes. And so the issue has been, nobody is able to bring about a judgment on sin. Nobody is able to establish righteousness, and weeping follows. Then the Lamb steps in. And when the Lamb steps in, he is pictured in terms of his cross, he dealt with sin. His power, he's going to be able to put down sin. And his intelligence, he will do it in perfect righteousness. That's, again, seeing these two balanced out, that it is power intelligently used by someone who is qualified to use it. And he's the only one in the universe that's able to do so. And this is the image that John wants us to have before we move into it. So, then we have had the victory, person involved, and now, second, the act involved. Person involved, and now the act involved. And that is found in verse 7. And he came, and by the way, verse 7 is intended to be dramatic. And notice how he builds us up. It says, and he came, and he took it out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. So the act involves a bit of drama in doing so. So notice this is, he takes the book in the role of the Lamb. The cross, think of it this way. The cross is Christ's title deed to the world. And it's what qualifies him to come and to take action, take the book, and execute judgment that is going to be poured out in the rest of the book. Notice also in taking the scroll from the hand of God the Father, he assumes ability to do what the Father can do. He assumes ability to do what God's right hand can do. And of course, God's hand is omnipotent, all-powerful. And he claims to take that, and notice the Father releases the book. I think probably the most sublime individual act in all of the book of Revelation has got to be this one right here. When all hope for execution of righteousness, bringing in righteousness, is gone until the Lamb steps forward, takes the book. This, then, being a sublime act, is now followed by the praise. 5:9-14. And first, we have the participants. 5:8. And when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having each one a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. Notice, first of all, and we have interpreted the 24 elders to be the church and the living beings to be cherubim. There you have then the joining of man and angel in worship. This would tie in quite well with what we call the Lord's Prayer, which is, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And we're going to see, coming through these events, how that we will terminate the book of Revelation with the will of God executed in heaven is going to come to earth. And so what's going on in heaven now will become an earthly scene. So this scene in heaven will become earthly, in that the will of God will be affirmed on earth the same way it is affirmed at this point in heaven. Notice also in verse 8 that these beings have harps. What is the idea of their harps? The first observation I would make is this. The most common praise combination in the Old Testament is song and harp. Song and harp. And that is the most common praise arrangement in all of the Old Testament. Whenever you are ready to praise, it inevitably, if you want to go with the odds, if there's going to be praise and worship, you can figure there's going to be singing and there's going to be harps connected with it. Let me give you one passage just to see that. Psalm 33:2. And I'm reading this as a sample passage linking song and harp. Verse 2, "Give thanks to the Lord with the lyre. Sing praises to him with a harp of 10 strings. And you're looking there at a very common thing as far as the Old Testament is concerned. So the song and the harp goes together. Now back to Revelation. And there's an interesting, very interesting thing here. Notice the number that are involved in this praise in heaven. Go down to verse 11. Number and cooperation. Verse 11 says, "I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, and the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was myriads, 10,000s of 10,000s, and thousands of thousands." Now, in the midst of all of this corporate worship, what do you tend to lose with bigness? With bigness, you tend to lose individuality, don't you? Well, I think it's interesting, if you look at the bigness there, at the same time there is bigness, there is individuality. Now, where do we get that? Verse 8. "And when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, having each one a harp. Notice, individuality is never lost. I take it what he's saying is there are no second harps. Everybody is first chair. And the emphasis is then that there is the worship of millions. There's also the retaining of individuality, so that you might look, well, I guess I'll get lost in these millions. No, you will not. You will have your own harp. And we will, representing our praise to the Lord, individuality is not lost. Second, notice their bowls. Latter part of verse 8. They have golden bowls full of incense. And this, contextually with the Old Testament, ties in to the service of priests. They're going to be doing, engaging in the service of priests. Also, the word incense, and it doesn't come through in English, if we would read that literally, it says golden bowls full of incenses. It's plural. So incense is plural. Why would that be? Well, the plurality of it can indicate two things. Number one, there's lots of it. It's full. But it can also be a reminder of the fact that it is not only full, it's diverse. All kinds of incenses. So it shows diversity in the plural. It also shows fullness as far as the plural is concerned. And I will conclude then with one word and one passage. Notice in verse 8, the golden bowls are full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And the thing we would want to say is this. Let's take time to write it out, because it's a beautiful thought, a beautiful truth. Prayer on earth is incense in heaven. Prayer on earth is incense in heaven. Practical application, have you made heaven fragrant today? One passage in connection with that, David had the concept of prayer being incense in Psalm 141 and verse 2. Psalm 141, verse 2. Prayer may seem very common on earth, but it is incense in heaven. And as Psalm 149 indicates, beginning in verse 1, O Lord, I call upon Thee, hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to Thee. May my prayer be counted as incense before Thee. And you have that, not just as a petition here, but as you have it as a reality in the book of Revelation. All right, we will begin next time with verse 9, which will look at the content of the praise. We've had the participants. And now our next point will be the content, which we will pick up with next time. And our Father, we are thankful that what may seem so common, praying, and so ordinary, we are so thankful for you opening the door and letting us know that as far as you're concerned, that's incense in your presence. And we're thankful that you view our prayers, though sometimes so unintelligent, that you view them in that particular way, that you view them with pleasure. It's incense in the nostrils of God Himself. And we get thankful for this, and we pray that as we prepare for the events of the book of Revelation, we will be prepared through chapters 4 and 5 to see the throne and the book and the Lamb who is qualified to put things together, to right wrong, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. For this we anticipate and give you thanks in Christ's name. Amen.